Welcome to Reality Check, a weekly podcast about anything and everything having to do with education. I'm Jeannie Allen. I'm the founder and CEO of the Center for Education Reform, where we've been working for almost 25 years to expand education opportunity and innovation in American education. Reality Check's a production of National Review, and I'm grateful to Charlie Cook and the whole gang at NR who make this and a growing other number of podcasts available. There are lots of places where you can find us, beginning with National Review Online, where you can drop by anytime, or by subscribing to Reality Check at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. So how did we choose the name Reality Check? Well, we found over the years that a lot of what you read about or see about education is wrong, or at least seriously misleading. In order to know really what's going on in our schools, in our educational learning venues across the country, or in higher ed, you really need a reality check. So let me just start with an important and favorite topic of mine, charter schools. Charter schools aren't the end-all and be-all of educational choice, of course, but they were the first big crack in the concrete wall that had been built around traditional American public schools since they began to take their present shape in the late 1800s. And 25 years after the nation's first charter school opened its door in 1992 in St. Paul, Minnesota, they've become a huge, not just alternative, they've actually become a huge impetus for change in traditional public schools in 44 states and the District of Columbia around the country. Our guest in today's Reality Check knows a heck of a lot about those early days in St. Paul and today. In fact, Joe Nathan has not only served in the capacity at a local level in things like PTA president in St. Paul, a member of the state PTA board, and more importantly, as a formative thought leader in the development of the charter school law in Minnesota, but he's also the author of four books, Charter Schools Creating Hope and Opportunity for American Education, Free to Teach, Public Schools by Choice, and Micromyths. And more about that will be linked onto our website so you can find Joe later. He's been an inner-city public school aide, a teacher administrator, holds a PhD from the University of Minnesota. As I said, he's helped write the nation's first charter school law. Joe's been married for 42 years to a recently retired St. Paul public school teacher, and their three children all attended and graduated from St. Paul Public Schools. Today, Joe is the director of the Center for School Change, which is now an affiliate of EdVision Schools and co-located at Higher Ground Academy in St. Paul. Former St. Paul Mayor George Latimer says the CSC's work is widely respected because it's based on careful research, has demonstrated excellent results, and reflects the desire to make a difference. I'm not only genuinely indebted and grateful to Joe for all the work he's been on as a pioneer in this field, but Joe and I also come to this from two completely polar opposite ideological perspectives today's day and age. And yet, somehow, Joe, you and I always managed to find ourselves in the same room when it came to education reform, education opportunity, education equity. So first, thank you so much for joining us, and I'd just love to hear you talk a little bit about what you're doing today.
Thanks to you, Jeannie, and thanks for your many efforts over decades now to try to improve outcomes for a vast array of youngsters in America. It's an honor to be with you, and as you said, we have some vigorous agreements and some disagreements, but I am deeply indebted to your fundamental efforts, which I think are unquestionably designed to help improve American education overall, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk with your listeners.
Well, thanks so much, Joe. So let's just jump in. You're sitting in Minnesota, the pioneer not only in charter schooling, but so many things in innovation, in teaching and learning. It's a very progressive state. And yet across the country, even though some upwards of 6% maybe of students attend public charter schools today across the country, and they're scattered and sometimes centered in different places, why is there still so much controversy about this notion that a parent or family should be able to choose a school outside of their zone zip code?
So let me just reiterate two quick things before I respond to your question. First, as you mentioned, I have been an inner city public school, district school teacher and administrator. All three of our youngsters attended urban public schools. My wife and I, my wife recently retired after 33 years as a public school teacher and administrator. And I'm a big fan of outstanding education, whether it's at district, charter, private, or parochial schools. So I don't consider myself a charter advocate or a district advocate. I consider myself an advocate for excellent public education, have worked over the last 45 years on that in various ways, including bringing schools of various types together to learn from and work with each other. So having said that, I think that there are from three fundamental battles going on in America that lead to challenges of people having choice among schools. The first is that the charter movement and alternative school movements before that were founded on the idea that schools can make a huge difference for youngsters. And there are a lot of people in this country who are paid a lot of money to try to convince folks that that's not true, that schools can't really make much difference in kids' lives. And I have had this debate literally for 45 years, well before the charter movement started, where people said, well, you really can't expect schools to make that much difference. I mean, the problems are fundamentally outside schools. I certainly agree that there are problems outside schools in neighborhoods and communities. Some families are troubled. But I think there's enormous evidence that schools can make a huge difference. But that is a debatable point, and that gets to some people. Secondly, there are huge issues of power and control. I remember when we started, a group of us started a public alternative school in 1971 here in St. Paul, and the NAACP was opposed. The teachers union was not very supportive. There was a belief, even though this was a part of the school system, that this was somehow going to hurt public education to offer options to families. Unfortunately, people didn't recognize then and don't recognize now that wealthy and affluent families have always had options. So right. That bothered me 45 years ago. It bothers me now. But anyway, there are issues of power and control.
And money, as you said, right? A lot of people paid a lot of money to defend the status quo. So let's put some names.
Let me just say one last thing there. The third reason is that there is a huge the research is frankly not definitive about almost anything in education. And so people can and do choose research to support their ideological points of view. I think those are three fundamental issues that I've seen in 45 years involved in public education and trying to improve schools and, most importantly, trying to help more students succeed.
Right. So ideological rigidity, money, and then the issues of power and control is what's really holding so many students back. In fact, you know, just, you know, the week of December 5th, the study that just came out, the International Assessment of Literacy across the country, found that once again, the United States has dropped in fourth grade literacy. So now we have dropped from fifth place to 13th behind Russia. Russia, Joe, right? And so here we are free to do amazing things, but in our schooling, in our enterprises around schooling, we have these rigid and fixed systems that we can agree across the political aisles don't serve children. So
yes, what, not so, enough. Many, far too many children are not succeeding, and this is a national disgrace.
And so, when you think about, you mentioned the NAACP and their opposition to charter schools. Here, you are someone who's been so committed to civil rights over the years. You wrote that great piece about Rosa Parks, which I'd love you to tell the story. About when you wrote that piece and how you really surfaced her support, and yet the rank and file don't seem to see that reality.
So, briefly going back to the Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks obviously will be well known to all of your listeners. Spent the last 5 years of her stated life trying to help start a chartered public school in Detroit. Unfortunately, this is often not discussed. A new biography has recently come out by a college professor in New York, which never mentions this, even though it was discussed in the New York Times. And I wrote to the professor and said, why don't you discuss this as part of your comprehensive biography? And I never received a response. But it is true. It is a fact that she did this. It is true that an aide to Martin Luther King, who was involved in helping to set up a chartered public school in New York, said that he thought Martin Luther King would have been strongly supportive of charter schools. It is true that there is ideological support across the political spectrum. I mean, you and I are on different sides often of the political spectrum, but as you know, I'm a Paul Wellstone Democrat, and he was a strong supporter of chartered public schools. So I think that, and I know that, you know, more conservative people such as yourself also find lots of reasons to like this idea. I want to mention one other thing that predates charters that happened here in Minnesota that also was fiercely opposed. And that is that in 1985, we passed a law in Minnesota with broad bipartisan support that allows high school students to take courses on college campuses full or part-time with state funds following students, so that the state funds leave the public schools if the students choose to attend full or part-time, and they pay all costs of tuition, books, and lab fees. So it's really a voucher following youngsters, and that has had a huge positive impact, even though when it was initially proposed in 1985, the Minnesota School Boards Association said it was the worst piece of legislation that had been adopted in many years.
Well, you know, and it may sound really like a long time ago to, let me just say, younger listeners right now, but I just think it's really important for you and I for a moment to talk about that history, because I remember having discussions with you when I was a young tot at the Heritage Foundation in the late 1980s. And you were like, what? Why is this person calling me from the Heritage Foundation? And you had just advised the nation's governors. And what was the name of the report, Joe? Turning a Tide or A Time for Results?
The Time for Results, which was a bipartisan effort done by the Bipartisan National Governors Association. The lead authors were then-Governor Lamar Alexander of Tennessee and then-Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas. So you can see people from two different parties who had a very strong vision of much better and effective public schools. And incidentally, in that report, Governor Alexander, now, of course, U.S. Senator, chair of a very important committee in education, Lamar Alexander said in some of the founding principles of chartering, the governors are ready for some old-fashioned horse trading. Right. We're ready. We are ready, the governor said. We are ready to give more flexibility and authority at the local school level if schools are building are willing to be more responsible for results. And that's the fundamental chartering chartering bargain right there.
I remember
that.
That
was not from Al Shanker. That was before Al Shanker, who's sometimes credited with this notion, which is really false.
It is so false.
More about that if you're interested.
It is so false. And
but,
we should talk about the AFT and Randy Weingarten, how they claim credit for this, which they don't. But let's go back to the governors for a second and the progression. Because the other thing they said is, yes, public school choice should be across the board. And I remember the NEA, and in fact, writing about the NEA at that time, said, oh my gosh, if kids can go to another public school, this is before charters, this is before any kind of other school choice, they can go to another public school, it'll be disastrous, and money will be lost, and teachers will lose their jobs. And there was this hue and cry. And then suddenly, that didn't happen. In fact, what happened is, as you've reported so many times, what, more than 20,000 students came back to the classroom who had dropped out because they were given not just the opportunity to go to another public school, but even to take high school college courses for high school credit. Talk a little bit about that post-secondary enrollment options, which, again, sounds so non-radical today, but back then was so radical.
Well, you've really summed it up. And what happened was that more than 150,000 youngsters since 1985 have used this law. We now have hundreds of students here in Minnesota who are literally graduating from high school in the same week or the same month. They have earned a two-year degree in college because they were able to take their last 2 years, the junior, senior year in high school, on a college campus. Or now, thanks to a terrific parent community organization effort that we were involved in this year, they can take college courses online, again, with dollars following the students. And this was described in 1985 when it was proposed as something that was going to destroy public education. In fact, what we've seen all over the state is that high schools have improved their own programs, adding new advanced placement, international baccalaureate, college and school courses. So that just as many of us predicted, both on the conservative and on the liberal side, when you introduce certain kinds of school choice, existing schools will improve. And that is certainly part of the idea.
And so let's really get to the nub of this, right? And it's something that I think a lot of people, certainly people that I grew up around, have a hard time with. The notion that in order to be effective, you may need to leave your school, right? So I remember, never forget, I probably told you the story. You know, I grew up in this, you know, beautiful, very middle class place in New Jersey that my father worked really hard to get us to. And it was just like Wobegon, right? It was everybody was average. Everyone was okay. And yet 30% of my high school class didn't end up going to a four-year school. And some of them actually never went to any higher education. And some of them actually said to me later when I'd run into them, you know, they did not serve me well, or they did not help me find my interest, or I was bored, or they didn't understand me. And so we know that over time, every parent, grandparent, person out there has a story about someone for whom schools did not fit, and yet for so long we try to fit them into the box. Now you take high school students who are sitting around, have reported in surveys over and over again, hey, we're bored. We don't think this is relevant to us. And so is that because the system we have really has changed so much? Have students changed so much, or have we never really gotten this right?
Well, those are great questions that could take us hours to discuss. I guess I'd say briefly three things. First of all, there are a lot of caring, committed, and talented folks working in our public schools, whether district or charter. However, I think the system is really discouraging to a lot of people, including some of the best people. One of the things that you'll find in chartered public schools around the United States is veterans of district public schools who are really, really frustrated. And one thing that Shanker did say in 1988, with which I agree, as a former president of the American Federation of Teachers, was that people who tried to start new kinds of options within public education, this is a direct quote, are treated like traitors or outlaws for daring to move outside the lockstep. Think of that. How would, in the most effective organizations, innovators would be treated the reverse of traitors and outlaws? And Shanker went on to say that people who were trying to create new kinds of options, if they somehow succeeded in creating a new option within public education, could look forward to insecurity, obscurity, and outright hostility. And unfortunately, we have a system that does not, in many cases, reward innovation. I want to mention one other author here that is very important, I think, for folks to understand as they think about chartering. Many people will be familiar with the Brown versus Board of Education, U.S. Supreme Court case, 1954. And they will perhaps remember the Dahl test that was developed by Kenneth and Mimi Clark, two African-American psychologists, to determine, which determined, unfortunately, in the 1950s, and sadly, it's been repeated recently and found the same thing, that white and African-American youngsters look at dolls that are identical, except that one is white and one is black, and they say that in many cases, majority cases, they'll say that the white doll is prettier. Well, Kenneth Clark was a huge advocate of the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954. By 1968, he wrote a remarkable article in the Harvard Education Review called Alternative Public Education, which I strongly encourage people to look up. And he says, in part, this is just a brief quote, "Alternatives, realistic, aggressive, viable competitors to the present public school systems must be found. The development of such competitive public school systems will be attacked by defenders of the present system as attempts to weaken the present system and therefore weaken, if not destroy, public education. This type of expected self-serving argument can be briefly and accurately disposed of by asserting and demonstrating that truly effective competition strengthens rather than weakens that which deserves to survive."
Oh, my gosh.
Now, that is Kenneth Clark, one of the principal authors of Brown versus Board of Education, speaking in 1968, calling for what is essentially the chartered public school system, alternatives to the present school system. And that's 1968. I think it's very important to understand that the public school systems have failed, have succeeded with many people, unquestionably, sure, but they have failed many. And that's one of the reasons why we have chartering.
And that's why we have chartering, exactly. And I would also go back to the notion that, you know, you started with earlier in this show, Reality Check, for those people who may have only just tuned in to their podcast, but you should roll back and listen to the rest of it, with Joe Nathan from Minnesota, a pioneer. You started by saying that, you know, people used to think that we couldn't possibly do anything for kids because, after all, they come to school poor, they come to school without enough words, and, you know, schooling is whatever we do in school, we can feed them, we can love them, we can care for them. How many of us have heard that? And after all, parents aren't, you know, some parents just don't know any better. You can't expect them to jump in. And flash, guess what we found? Not just with traditional public school choice, open enrollment in the late 80s, but then chartering, that even the worst off parent, even the person in the most desolate situation, finds a way to and knows instinctually that baby, whether born, adopted, inherited, whatever, what that child needs. And, you know, Joe, you and I could talk forever, many of us could, about how many parents we've met in cities and rural areas and other places who have actually articulated the argument for their child, frankly, better than a lot of people that I know in my echelon would. And so, you know, going back to this notion of here was someone, Kenneth Clark of the 60s, saying that fundamentally we need a different kind of school system to suit our kids so that they all can live and breathe together and do well, it's extraordinary. And so I don't know about you, but I have a sense of urgency around this, right? We're in 2017, soon to be in 2018. Just several days ago, you know, yet another one of these hit jobs on charter schools came up about from the Associated Press of all sources, almost parroting what Randy Weingarten, the head of the AFT, said several months ago about school choice being a polite cousin of segregation. And they said that charter schools are racially isolating people. By the way, folks, they looked at a federal set of data, which requires a lot more expertise than looking through a bunch of numbers, and made this conclusion. So Joe, we know that's not the case. How do you parse that? How do you parse what was said? in that report?
Well, I think it was an astonishingly ignorant and poorly designed piece of work, frankly. And I do have a PhD, and I have been asked by the National Governors Association and by governors in more than 30 states to work with them to help improve schools, district chartered, as well as colleges and universities. I have worked at the University of Minnesota. I have worked at McAllister College and at St. Thomas. And frankly, I thought it was an extraordinary, shabby piece of work. So here are three things to think about. The first is that the article and the research doesn't seem to differentiate, doesn't differentiate between youngsters being forced to attend an inferior school because of their race and youngsters actively, or their families, actively selecting a school. Uses the same word, segregation. It's just totally different. And I've written a column with a good friend who is the first African-American elected to the St. Paul, Minnesota school board, who explained that when he was growing up in the late 1940s and early 1950s in Indiana, he was, because he was African-American, forced to go to a school further from his home because he was African-American, and he was sent to an inferior school. He was sent to the school. He had no options. Now, after having been elected to the city council, having been the Minnesota Commissioner of Education, he's founded a school that's won many awards from U.S. News and World Report, from the local newspapers, from other places, for being a quote-unquote beat-the-odds school, and it's virtually all African-American. And he points out there's a huge difference between actively selecting a school and being assigned to a school that's inferior because of your race. And often, advocates who are opposed to charters don't understand it. So that was one problem. The second problem is just a frank, disingenuous approach. Most of the charters in the United States are in inner-city areas. However, as you note, many of them now, a growing number of them, are in suburban and rural areas, because many rural and suburban families are finding that they're not happy with traditional schools. But anyway, going back to that article, I think it was really poorly done. A professor at the University of Washington has just written an excellent commentary, Robin Lake, about what's
fantastic.
Wrong with it. But the point, so that's the second point. Third quick point is that this article, and frankly much of American journalism and education reporting, ignores the wonderful experience of historically black colleges and tribally controlled colleges. We have convened a meeting a couple of years ago where national authorities on historically black colleges and tribally controlled colleges came, and much more information is available on our website. And I'm not saying everybody ought to go to a historically black college, not saying everybody, all American Indians ought to go to a tribally controlled college, but the research on these is very powerful, where young people who go to these institutions have a wonderful record of success, far better record of success in many ways than African-Americans who go to what they call predominantly white institutions.
Well,
so,
look, like what you're pointing
yes,
out.
I think families ought to have options, but my point, just briefly here, my point is that this research and a lot of American educational journalism just ignores these examples of institutions controlled by people of color where people of color have done marvelously.
Well, and so one of the things that you're pointing out also is it really depends. It depends on the student. It depends on the individual. And here we are in the, again, most, you know, prosperous country in the world, the most free country in the world. And even though a lot of people still can't participate in the future, it's because they don't have the ability to help fit the school to them. They have to usually fit the child to the school. I remember years ago meeting with psychologists at a university that was going to begin authorizing charter schools. And the psychologist said, well, we've been waiting for education to catch up with us and recognize that all children are different. Hey, Joe, on your Twitter feed, which is at JoeNathan9249, you also had something a few days ago about Minnesota district and charter public schools beating the odds. So the other piece of this is we can talk about choice, which, of course, is the bedrock foundation of our country. We can talk about the importance of allowing poor people in particular to have the kind of power that affluent people have. Then there's the results, right? Everywhere you look, when we were having discussions in the 90s about why we need education opportunity, it wasn't because we all just wanted to go into our own hive and hide. It was because we wanted better results. And aren't we seeing that, in fact, that city by city, state by state, not only have charters improved, but districts have improved almost as a direct result, right?
Absolutely. And I think, once again, this is left out of the AP story. It's left out of a lot of discussions about education. As I said earlier, there are some outstanding district schools. But one of the things that chartering has done has been encourage improvement in traditional district schools in some places. Here are three quick examples. Here in Minnesota, we recently convinced we being some union presidents, teacher union presidents, and some charter advocates, convinced the legislature to allocate money to help district teachers start new options. The teacher unions were interested in this because there have been literally thousands, tens of thousands of families who are going to charters that weren't going there 20 years ago. The number of youngsters going to charters here in Minnesota has jumped from 100 in 1992 to more than 60,000 this year. And meanwhile, the number of youngsters attending district schools has gone down by about 50,000. So the district schools still enroll the majority of kids, but districts are seeing in rural, urban, and suburban communities are seeing kids moving to charters. So the teacher union presidents in St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Lakeville, a first ring suburb, decided that they wanted to go to the legislature, and charter advocates agreed. So this convinced the legislature to help district teachers start new options. So that's an example. In Forest Lake, which is a suburban school district about 25 miles north of St. Paul, group of parents said, we want a Montessori school as an option. District said, no, we're not going to do that. We don't believe in options. The family said, well, we really do, but if you won't do it, we'll set up a Montessori school. But the district school board said, don't do that. We'll create a Montessori school.
Remember that.
That's a district responding constructively. Many people have heard of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. It's basically the same story. A group of parents went to the school board and said, we want a core knowledge school based on the ideas of E.D. Hirsch, a terrific education authority in the United States. Board said no. Parents said, then we'll set up a charter. Board said, let's work together. And they did. And I could spend the next hour. I won't, but I could spend the next hour giving examples. Let me give one last example.
Sure.
In Boston, the teachers union went to the school board and said, we, the teachers in Boston, would like to create new options within the system. We want to be empowered to do that. We want to be empowered to create the kind of schools we think make sense. The school board said, no, we're not going to let you do that. Then the charter law passes in Massachusetts, and a group of teachers said, well, if you're not going to let us create these options within the system, then we'll start to create charters. The school committee, that's the school board, what they call the school board in Boston, school committee reversed itself and said, no, we're going to let you do that. That's a good idea. And so they created pilot schools. My point here is
it's a ripple effect.
That chartering has encouraged existing systems to improve.
And not only encourage existing systems to improve, but, you know, we come back to the whole notion of innovation, which we're passionately focused on at the Center for Education Reform. And so many people are, Joe, as you are. You know, innovation can only happen in institutions that have the flexibility, autonomy, and ability to take risks. I don't mean risks like we're going to hang our kids out to dry. I mean, hey, how can we maybe do reading differently today? Might we take our kids outside and experiment with what if there's different learning styles or different things we can gain by different approaches? Might we change the way we pay teachers, reward them, incentivize them? Might they take on additional responsibilities? By the way, we'll have another show someday on how union contracts stifle the ability of teachers to actually earn more, have more authority, and be the professionals that they should be. But that innovation, really, at the end of the day, aren't we all talking about making every school work for every child?
Well, I think you and I have a slight disagreement about that, because I don't think every school can work for every child. I think that's one of the reasons that we do offer options. I mean, some youngsters will succeed in a Montessori school. Some youngsters will succeed in a more traditional school. And so I think we offer options because, as somebody said to me, we have more options. We have more like shoes of different sizes. Everybody isn't a size 10. Everybody doesn't fit into the same kind of school. But
right,
I want to
put
back
it.
To an earlier point that you made just briefly. It was the point about innovation and giving teachers a chance to create new kinds of options and what's the environment where that happens. One of the things that, again, started here in Minnesota as a result of chartering is that a group of teachers created a school based on the farmer co-op. These are rural teachers. And their parents had been members of farm co-ops, where it was the farmers who themselves got together, worked together, hired somebody to help them, and then, you know, worked together to improve their farms and to sell their products. Well, that same principle has now been applied to public education. We now have public schools, district and charter, where the teachers are in charge.
Okay.
We have charters here in Minnesota and several other states where the teachers make up the majority of board of directors, and they operate a little bit like some medical practices or some attorney practices, where it's the teachers who are in charge.
Right.
And we now have union people coming in to meet with these folks and, in fact, promoting this idea of teacher-led schools. But once again,
to learn from
going back to a key point you made, this is happening in part because Families are now empowered to select among different kinds of schools.
And I'm going to go ahead, and that's such an amazing note to wrap on, Joe. This has been extraordinary. It's been such a quick 30 minutes, and I want to help Joe. I want to, again, thank Joe Nathan, who is a pioneer from Minnesota, and you can get more information from our website, edreform.com, about Joe. But I want to also thank our listeners. Thanks for checking in with us on our Reality Check. You can subscribe to Reality Check at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn. Never miss an episode. I'm Jeannie Allen, and I look forward to having you talk with us again about the realities of education in America today. Thanks so much. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. And for folks who want to find out about some of the materials that I mentioned, it's www.centerforschoolchange.org. But thanks so much for doing this.
Awesome. Thank you.